Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, May 27th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
So today, it's our monthly series, The Big Fix, where we debate solutions to some tough problems facing the country. And this hour, we're taking on kids and big tech. You may have seen that the Surgeon General's office issued a warning last week about excessive screen use and the harm it is doing to young people, linking it to growing rates of anxiety, depression, poor sleep, and social relationships.
But recently, we've seen lawmakers, schools, and parents begin to tackle the issue and push back against big tech. Countries are banning social media for kids under 16. States are passing age verification laws. And many more are restricting phones in classrooms. There's also a grassroots parents movement to get tech out of schools, including one in our region. Plus, the social media companies Meta and YouTube were recently held accountable for harming young users in a landmark verdict this March.
Yeah, so can we make technology safe and healthy for kids and teens? And who should be setting the limits? Government, the tech companies, schools, parents? The kids themselves. We brought together three experts on kids and tech to pitch their big ideas for combating this issue. They've each brought two solutions to the table. So with us in studio, we have Desmond Upton Patton, the Penn Integrates Knowledge Professor at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also founding director of the Safe Lab and a member of the Children and Screens Evidence Council. Desmond, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me.
We also have Gene Twenge, a professor of psychology at San Diego State University and author of 10 Rules for Raising Kids in a High-Tech World. She is an expert witness in trials against the social media companies. Jean, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you.
And last but not least, we have Casey Mock, Senior Policy Director at The Anxious Generation, a lecturer in applied ethics and tech policy at Duke University. He's also the author of the Substack newsletter, Tomorrow's Mess. Casey, we're happy to have you.
Hey, y'all. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
And we're also happy to have our listeners. We'd love to hear from you this hour. Yeah. We're really interested about your potential solutions to all of this. Have you seen big tech impacting your kids? What's your fix? How do you think about screen time in your own life? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. And yes, we are on social media platforms, Facebook and YouTube. If you are there, comment in the live chat.
And before we launch our discussion, though,
we do have to unveil. Thank you for reminding me of that. See, new things. we have to unveil a new summer feature on Studio 2. It is called Giveaway Wednesday. Mm-hmm. Every Wednesday this summer, we're giving out two pairs of tickets to an upcoming event in the region. So you have to stick around to the end of the show for the reveal of this week's Giveaway Wednesday event and your chance to win.
Okay, so we're going to jump into round one of the Big Fix. And our big thinker who's up first is Gene Twenge. Gene, you have a Big Fix idea, and yours is delay, delay, delay. Lay out your Big Fix and the rationale behind it.
Yeah, so the idea is parents, you know, with, of course, support from other parents and hopefully buy-in from their kids, to delay giving a smartphone for as long as possible, really, and delay giving any phone for as long as possible. So when I wrote 10 rules, this was what I was really trying to help parents with. I have three teenage kids myself. And two of the rules are, one, that first phones should be basic phones. So when you've kicked that can down the road as long as possible, but then, you know, your kid needs to be picked up from sports or they're at that age when everybody is texting their friends, say 12 or 13, don't hand them a smartphone, get them a basic phone. So they still make flip phones, or even better, there are phones designed for kids. They're built on Android platforms that allow kids to call and text, and then other apps at the parent's discretion, but no social media. No gambling apps, and crucially, no AI boyfriends or girlfriends, because that's the new thing that we have to worry about. Yeah. And then, so when do they actually get the real smartphone with internet access and more accessibility to apps? Well, we came up with the idea in our house that's worked really well, is you get your first smartphone when you get your driver's license. So that's going to be 16, 17 in some states. You're going to have that freedom to go see your friends rather than have that kind of false choice of mom and dad are busy. So I'm going to go see my friends on Snapchat. No, you can get in the car and go see them yourself. Because if you live in a suburban area like I do, that's really crucial for kids. You can modify that in an urban area to say, when you are getting around the city by yourself on public transportation and you're 16, then you can get the smartphone.
And so, Jean Twenge, gotta get, sounds like a great idea, but there's a lot of parents of teenagers right now who are, you gotta lay out the argument as to why, and then how do you sort of lay down the rules? Because, you know, kids are gonna advocate, especially teenagers, for themselves that they need it, all their friends are on it. So give us the rationale and then the arguments to sort of lay down the law here.
So the rationale is pretty simple, just that kids are not ready for smartphones because internet access, they can go anywhere. That can be pornography, it can be gambling. Parental control apps, I do recommend them, but there's workarounds. I hear about that from parents all the time. So if you can give them more that basic phone where there's not as many workarounds, it really makes things really easier for parents. And then kids still have access to the apps that are usually most important to them, which is often being able to text their friends. So there's a long discussion that we could have about the implications here. So social media being one of the biggest ones, that the more hours a day a teen spends on social media, the more likely it is that he or she will be depressed. We have a lot of experimental studies now showing that when people cut back or give up social media for at least a week or so, they end that time happier and less depressed. So there's lots of reasons to be concerned about this. I mean, not to mention all the things about unknown adults being able to easily contact kids on social media. Snapchat is the favorite app of drug dealers. The AI boyfriends and girlfriends that I mentioned, there's really a long list here of things that today's parents didn't grow up with, right? So we're not always aware of all of those dangers, understandably.
So some people might argue, like, look, social media, smartphone usage, this is a reality, and part of becoming an adult, part of growing up, is learning how to deal with the world as it's going to be presented to you. Someday, these kids are going to have to figure out how to safely use social media, how to use smartphones in a way that doesn't, ruin their lives. Why not sort of bring them along slowly instead of saying nothing, you can't have anything until a certain age?
We do that with everything else. We do that with driving. We do that with alcohol. It's not like we're like, kids should learn how to use alcohol responsibly. So let's let 13-year-olds kind of ease into it. They can have beer, and just walk into the liquor store and walk. I mean, we would never do that. So there's a long history of age gating. There's a long history of choosing an age and sticking with it. And I think we need to do the same for social media. Plus this argument of, oh, they need to learn how to use it and be respond. I mean, it's really a false argument because there's first, social media is very easy to learn how to use. Most people can learn how to use apps in about 10 minutes. And why not have them learn how to do that and be responsible when they have the brain development and maturity to be more responsible, which is going to be more like 16, 17, 18, not 10 or 11 or 12 or even 13 like it is these days.
Also on your
13 supposed, sorry, just what to really quick, 13's supposed to be the minimum age, but it's not enforced. So this is the other huge problem is we have 10, 11, 12-year-olds on these apps routinely.
That you have another idea coming that's more about like what government can do and policy fixes, but I'm interested also that your first one is about sort of parents taking the initiative. And I think you hinted at this idea of like parents banding together in some ways, like setting a new norm for parents. I wanted you to go a little deeper on that, why you think that's important, this sort of like level of change that's at like the unit level, the parent level, the household level. Why a fix that kind of puts the, maybe in some ways, the burden on the individual?
And I should be clear, I think it would be much better if we did pass a law like Australia did, raising the minimum age
Yeah, we'll get
to
to that. We'll
16.
get to that.
Yeah, because parents are in a really tough position. Again, I know this having three teenagers. And I don't think the burden should completely be on parents, but that's where we are. That is unfortunately the reality. So that means parents have to try to take action on this. And it is hard to do it as just at, when you're alone. It's hard to do this as my kid's going to be the only one. And I know that because that was my kids. And I've talked to many parents who their kids were the, quote, the only ones. And usually it's not really the only ones. But you can come together with other parents to say, agree that you're not going to get your kids' smartphones until later. So there's a group called Wait Until Eighth that does this. Say they're not going to get their kids' smartphones till the end of eighth grade. I would push it a couple more years, but it's a great start because then at least we keep them out of middle school.
At the very least, that would be wonderful.
A tough year. And I want to give, before we move on to the next big fix, want to give you Desmond and Casey an opportunity to react to Jane's big idea.
Absolutely. So, like, I think there are certainly elements of this idea that I certainly agree with. I certainly believe that helping young people get closer and closer to human connection and that being central to how they experience what it means to be a child is wonderful. However, what I get concerned about is like over policing young people's experience with technology. So oftentimes we talk about bans of social media, bans of cell phone. And I think what we're learning is that the data and the evidence is mixed. Some of it is not rigorous. Some of it is still inconclusive. And I think it's important that we take a moment and sit with the idea that maybe we don't have all the answers yet. Mm-hmm. And I would rather parents be thinking very closely about how do I have deeper conversations about what my child needs and be able to think about how do I get the right data points to make that decision. And so I think,
so how should parents do that then? Because that's going to be tough for an individual parent to assess. It's a little easier to say, look, I'm just going to not do the phone until a certain point, because then I, you know, as someone who's not an expert, I don't have to make that judgment call.
Yeah. We have to communicate. We have to talk directly to parents. And oftentimes we're developing policies that are made by people at very high levels, by researchers, by politicians. And yet oftentimes those policies are not informed by young people and they're not informed by parents. And so I think that if we're going to have a real conversation about this, we have to think about how we democratize the conversation. We have to have parents at the table and young people at the table.
And I guess,
Gene, I want to get your response to that. This idea that maybe it's a little too harsh or draconian to say, and I'm summarizing a little bit, but like just say just no phone until a certain point.
So I think I should be clear. You know, in my book, one of the first things I say is yes, absolutely, you should talk to your kids. However, especially when they're teenagers, that's not enough. And it's actually easier to just say, you're going to get a phone at this age, rather than say, we're going to talk about it. We're going to see if you're ready. We're not really sure. Then your kid is going to be on you every second. I'm ready now. Let's have the phone. It's so much simpler to say, you're going to get the phone with the driver's license. And then before then, here you have this phone where you can text your kids. I also have to say the evidence is not inconclusive. It is not mixed. We have hundreds of studies showing this link between time spent on social media and depression. We have a ton of meta-analyses just in the last few years of the experimental studies. This idea that it's inclusive or mixed, like, is extremely outdated. We know a lot about this now. It really isn't mixed anymore at all. And this is what I do for a living. I mean, just for to be clear about this, I've done about 30 of these studies myself. I have reviewed the literature many times. So I have to disagree on that point.
Casey, why don't you chime in on this as we get ready to move on?
Yeah, thank you. So I would agree with Gene on this on a variety of points, but a few things. I think first on her point that there are actually democratic voices being heard on this. Like the phone-free schools movement would not exist were it not for parents and moms in particular around the country, like speaking up and demanding change. I talk to parent groups all the time who are really leading the way at, you know, really fighting for change in their schools. We're seeing in the news recently a pushback from parent groups about AI in the classroom in particular. And this also extends to young people as well. There was a op-ed that John Haidt published in the New York Times last year called Gen Z Has Regrets. And it's really telling that I think close to half of the members of Gen Z report wishing that TikTok and Twitter had never been invented at all. So that's a pretty powerful voice coming from young people, I think, that they really want change here too.
But whose parents and whose kids are we talking to? I guarantee that we're not going to West Philly and talking to kids of West Philly High. We're not going to the South and West Sides of Chicago and talking to those young people and those parents. So this idea that at 16, that every parent in the world or in the United States should just turn off the access to social media is not necessarily realistic for all parents.
And so,
can you expand on that? Sorry, but yeah, what makes it different for that group of parents in your mind?
Well, what I've learned in my own research is that cell phones and social media can be lifelines for a lot of young people and for a lot of parents, right? Being able to reach their child, being able to communicate with different types of folks is really important to a lot of young people. So to cut that off, particularly for a 14-year-old who may have a parent that has to walk, who has to work a lot of hours, what does that mean for them, right? Yeah. And so I think we have to consider different types of families when we think about these policies as well.
And so we're going to go to a break in a couple minutes, but I wanted to give you the opportunity, Desmond, to lay out your first big idea.
Yeah.
And your big idea is community-based digital care teams.
Yeah.
I had never heard of this. So explain your idea, break it down, and the rationale behind it.
Yes, I'm a social worker and a gun violence researcher, and I think the thing that I have studied for the last 10 years is the impact that social media is having on young people in schools that leads to harm, leads to gun violence, leads to eating disorders, mental health challenges. And the reality that we haven't really talked about yet is understanding social media as the new neighborhood. Young people are living their lives online. They're spending an enormous amount of time. They're communicating. They're getting news. They're finding love. And there's a lot of harm and pain there. But yet the schools are not treating social media as a neighborhood. It is this kind of user-centric kind of dynamic where if we just turn it off, then everything kind of fixes. But a lot of people, as I said before, are living their lives online. So what would it mean for schools, for every school in the United States, to develop care teams, use folks who are already in schools? You have school social workers, school nurses, parent groups, administrators, teachers, and young people to think about how do we support young people online? So how might we interpret the kind of things that we're seeing online? I study language, African-American English, on social media, and oftentimes parents, administrators don't know what young people are saying online, and yet they're creating policies based on things that they don't know a lot about. So how do we make sure that we have the right expertise in the room to understand the language that's being communicated? And then what happens when something harmful happens on social media, right? Oftentimes in the schools that I work in, schools are thinking about, okay, we're having prom, but then there is a fight that's brewing on TikTok, and yet there's a disconnect between understanding why that fight is happening and what we should do about prom.
How do we mitigate that gap? So is this like training for school officials and employees so they can better interpret what's happening online, or when a threat comes to them, they're able to understand what's the sort of the nuts and bolts of it, I suppose?
I think it's bigger than interpretation. I think interpretation is a key factor, but I think it's really about support. Right? What do we do when we see negativity online in a way that we're not just calling it out? Calling it out is important, but how do we make sure that we're supporting young people in the long run?
It sounds to me that your solution is different from Gene's in the sense that your argument is more like, you know, this is already out the bag. You can't put it back in. How do you deal with the situation as it currently exists?
Absolutely. I talk to schools all the time who are like, we don't know what to do about social media. We're trying the younger patches. We're trying to have conversations, yet the connection is still not happening. So how do we make sure that folks who are in the school buildings are prepared for the kind of interactions that may happen on social media?
So yeah. How would you propose doing that, though? So let's imagine it's me, like I'm, you know, an elder millennial who has no idea what any of this stuff means. I'm like on Instagram, but I'm not on TikTok. I'm barely on Facebook. How would you get me as a school employee or this theoretical person like up to speed so that they could be helpful?
Well, I think a couple ways. One is the convening power of bringing people together is really important. And one thing we're not saying is that young people are experts on the digital lives, right? And so what would it mean to bring together a young person who's active on social media, who knows a lot about social media, and for them to share with the millennial who's not active about who they talk to? What features are they using? How are they using those features? Why do they use those features? What are the triggers that take
the kids would talk to the teachers about, teach them?
Let's share knowledge, right? Let's share knowledge. Let's share expertise. But let's first understand that young people and community members have that expertise as well.
Yeah. And we have about a minute and a half left. So Casey, Jean, would love to get your thoughts on this sort of the idea that, you know what, the cat's already out the bag. How do you deal with the current situation? Your thoughts, Jean, Casey, on Desmond's idea.
I mean, you know, obviously making those connections and communicating at schools is a great idea. You know, I think we just disagree that I don't think the idea that, oh, the cat's out of the bag and there's nothing we can do is the way to go here. I think there's a lot that we can do to cut back on social media use so it doesn't become excessive. It is not the only way by any means for kids to communicate with their parents or even their friends. There's so many other avenues available to them. In terms of internet access and texting, and it doesn't have to be algorithmic social media for them to connect with their friends and their communities and their parents. There's so many other ways that they can do it. Yeah. And I should be clear too that the research that I was discussing is from nationally representative samples, and when you break it down by socioeconomic status or race or ethnicity or any other variable, the results look exactly the same.
Casey, your thoughts on how to, I guess, train people up, adults up, so that they can be more effective communicators with kids in this space?
Well, I think what I like about Desmond's suggestion is actually what my response would have been to his feedback on the last suggestion, which is we can't just take things away without providing infrastructure to replace it. Because what's happened over the last generation is that things like social media have really filled a void of this deterioration of local social infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And how, what that infrastructure looks like is different from community to community, right? In some places it was the church, and we've had declines in church attendance. But regardless, across the country, we've had this sort of fraying of social connections, yeah. Right? And if we just take away these platforms and don't put anything yeah. back in the place, of course, that's going to be dissatisfying. Yeah.
Well, we have more ideas to come, including Casey's first big fix. We want to yep. continue to hear yours. We'll get to some comments on the other side of this break. Our number is 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. We want your fixes on big tech and kids right here on Studio 2 from WHYY.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We're talking about kids and big tech on this month's Big Fix episode, where we bat around solutions to big problems. There is growing concern among parents, researchers, schools, and lawmakers that kids are spending too much time online, staring at screens, scrolling on social media, and playing video games, and it's all leading to anxiety, depression, and more.
Yeah, we brought together three people with different expertise and asked them to bring some possible fixes to this problem to the table, and we've been going through their ideas, and let me reintroduce them. We have Desmond Upton Patton, the Penn Integrates Knowledge Professor at the University of Pennsylvania and founding director of the Safe Lab. We have Jean Twenge, a psychology professor at San Diego State University and author of 10 Rules for Raising Kids in a High-Tech World. And last but not least, Casey Mock, Senior Policy Director of the Anxious Generation. He's also a lecturer in Applied Ethics and Tech Policy at Duke University.
How have you seen big tech impacting kids? What's your solution? How do you think about screen time in your own life? We'd love to hear from you. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, comment in the live chat. Real Aquaman on YouTube says, my daughter is 13 and has a phone. I maintain the screen controls on it. XXJ on YouTube has an interesting solution. I bought a smartphone for my daughter and completely disassembled it. I told her, this is your phone, build it, and you can have it. Mm. Okay, so Casey, let's get to your first big idea. It says here, a right to cognitive liberty.
Interesting.
We're here in the, just like a block or so from Independence Hall. It feels very constitutional. What is cognitive liberty? What are you talking about?
Well, before I get into it, I just want to say that, you know, what my idea here is about, and actually my second idea as well, is actually, in a way, it's like Jean's idea about changing a norm, right? Her idea was changing a norm in a household. And what I'm talking about here is changing the norms of how companies make money. So to get kids off screens, we've got to change how the companies approach making money from kids and how they design their products to maximize profits from kids. And one way that they make money from kids is by promoting overuse of their products. So this is the foundation of the attention economy. The company's understanding that our attention is a finite resource, and if they capture it and they monetize it, they can sell it to advertisers. They thus have every incentive to have kids on their platforms as much as possible. Now, our societal expectation, and actually expectations to date under the law up until recently, has been that it's been permissible. It's been allowable for companies to encourage that overuse unless and until someone proves that it's actively harmful. So we need to flip that presumption. We need to flip that norm. And we also need to flip the norm that manipulating you, that taking advantage of your, using algorithms to take advantage of your vulnerabilities is also not permissible.
So how do we flip that?
What's the practical way to do that?
I'm trying to imagine coming to a social media company and saying, you know, you have to water down your product essentially because, you know, generally companies want to maximize the appeal of whatever they're producing, whether it's a social media app or a candy bar. How are we flipping this, Casey?
So think about your house, right? You have a presumption that a stranger may not enter your house. You have to invite a stranger to your house, right? And if a stranger comes to your home, the stranger is expected to follow your rules. The way that it happens now with social media companies is YouTube or Instagram or Snapchat is essentially allowed to enter the home of your mind, your child's mind, and they set the rules. As so long as you click accept those terms and conditions when you sign up to the platform, you are following their rules. And so by establishing a right to cognitive liberty, which is the right to your own mind, the right to be free of algorithmic manipulation without your knowledge or consent, that all of a sudden flips that on its head. So in order for these products to sort of make their way into your ecosystem, they have to completely change all their default assumptions.
And by the way, you've also said this is not just about social media. It's also games like Roblox, gambling apps, and other things. And so what are some examples that you think could give me a concrete example? What could be something that companies have to change if we flip everything, this norm? Give me a concrete example of how things would shift.
Sure. Absolutely. So I'll give you two, one that's social media and one that is not. So first on Instagram, we know from Senate testimony from last year from Sarah Wynne Williams, a former Facebook executive, that Instagram, the app, knows when you delete a selfie from your phone. And Instagram chooses that moment when a teenage girl deletes a selfie to serve her an ad for a beauty product on the theory that she's emotionally vulnerable and feeling self-conscious about her body image then. That's deeply manipulative. And in a way that I think no one in their right mind, and certainly no parent in their right mind, would sign up to permit their, you know, teenage daughter or teenage
son. So there would
be
a way to turn
that
off, is what you're saying. Or that would not
correct.
Be on
that would
at
just
all.
Be
it would not be on at all.
Correct. That would be not permissible at all.
So it'd be like in second, that case, it would be Instagram would not have access, like photo roll access or like we're not tech people here. Like, and I know no one here is like a computer scientist, but I guess it's the feasibility of it, matching the feasibility with the idea. The idea sounds very appealing. And then I get to the feasibility and I'm like, so how do you get into the weeds of this and like put it in a law, right? Because I think ultimately, right, would have to be in a law, right, Casey?
Right. So the what would be illegal is using live data about your emotional state to serve you advertising.
Okay.
Any,
that should not be permissible.
Yeah. Any reaction?
Yeah,
Desmond,
absolutely.
Jane,
I mean, I love a lot of the things that Casey is saying. And I think what I would love to hear more about is the point that you've been alluding to is how do we actually operationalize this work? So I sit on TikTok's U.S. Content Advisory. And, you know, for years, we're constantly trying to get TikTok, but other platforms to think critically about features, right? The design of the platforms, right? I've been saying for years, live is actually really scary for the folks that I work, for the communities that I work in, because it can create violence, it starts violence, it amplifies violence. But the challenge is when you're trying to talk to the C-suite and you don't have a use case that makes sense to them, that they can understand, then it just goes into the ether. And so I would love to think about how do we take this brilliant idea that Casey has and figure out how do we create transparency portals around the things that platforms are already doing.
Yeah,
so that
a
we
lot
can get
of it we don't even know, right?
You don't
how,
know.
How do we get inside the black box, Gene? Do you have ideas for that? Because I do think a lot of this comes back to it feels like magic to the layperson, mm-hmm. how all of this works, how these algorithms are designed, what they actually do, what data they're grabbing, and how they're turning it into action. Is there a way to take that black box and make it at least not opaque anymore?
I mean, that's one of the things that a lot of people are advocating for, is a lot more transparency about how these things are done at the level of the tech companies, that how they develop these algorithms, how they work, so people can understand them better. I don't think that will solve all of our problems. I still think we need more regulation and parents stepping in. But it would certainly be helpful if we understood more about how these algorithms work, because they poured billions of dollars into them, because that's how they make their profit, is to keep people on for as long as possible.
Yeah. And so we're going to move on to Gene Twenge's next Big Fix idea. By the way, Sid on Facebook says parents need to monitor their kids' internet usage. !! George on Facebook says regulations and stiff financial and criminal, if appropriate, penalties would help. And so, Gene Twenge, your second Big Fix idea relates to federal age verification. So let's dig into it. Lay out your second Big Fix. How would it work? And, you know, what would the law look like?
So Australia has been a pioneer in this area. They raised the minimum age for social media accounts to 16 and required age verification. So that went into effect in December. They're still, you know, trying to figure out exactly how to get it to work, because they do have to work out those logistical issues. But it has led to a huge reduction in the number of kids 15 and under using these platforms. So I think this is really inspirational. A bunch of other countries have followed that. It would be amazing if the U.S. could be one of them. I'm not tremendously optimistic that that might happen, but we, at the very least, maybe we can get our current age minimum of 13 enforced.
Yeah.
I mean, there's very few people who think that having kids 12 and under be on social media is a fantastic idea, yet we are not enforcing that age minimum of 13, which is too young, but that would be at least a start mm-hmm. of having meaningful age verification. Because right now, you just check a box or you choose a birth year that makes you over 13 and you're in.
Yeah.
And, you know, 11-year-olds all know how to do that.
They know how to count,
you know,
right?
As far as I can tell. Yeah, exactly. You know, they've learned enough math so they can figure out how to do that. And, you know, you can create multiple accounts. If you get kicked out the first time, you can go back and then just try again. It's very, very easy for 12 and unders to get on these platforms.
And Gene, what
right
about
now?
The privacy argument, though? A lot of people say, you know what, there's a lot of privacy issues. Once you start doing this age verification, your response?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways to respond to that. So one is, really, for social media, when they already know absolutely everything about us from you know, how we have signed away our right to privacy when we sign up for an account, I think it's a little ironic. Plus, I think when people make that argument, they assume it has to be government ID, and that's not true. There are so many companies that will verify age online that they have their own trade association. And they have a list of all the companies that do it and all of the ways that they can do it. And government ID is only one among many, many other ways that it can be done. A lot of times they're using AI, facial recognition or facial age techniques. You can put in, you know, maybe a credit card and then have it charged 1 cent and then have that even 1 cent charge rolled back. There's a bunch of ways that this can be done. Yeah.
And would it be, just to clarify, that Australia has its law, but in your ideal law, Gene, what's classified as social media? Like, is YouTube included in that? Is it just sort of like the big three, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, maybe throwing Snapchat?
Gaming?
Gaming, Roblox. Like, what do you think should be in the umbrella? Yeah. And what do you think, like, let's leave it outside because, like, this is a tool that kids do need access to?
Yeah, so I think that's a real judgment call. And I don't necessarily really take a strong position on that. Australia went back and forth on several platforms. YouTube is a great example of something that is longer form video that can be used in education, that you know, maybe there's other workarounds. Maybe it can be put in the Canvas page and you don't have to have an account. I mean, that's the other way that states and countries have tried to do it, of you can watch YouTube, you just can't have an account. So then it can't algorithmically feed you things. So that'd be the other way to do it. But absolutely, TikTok, Snapchat, and Instagram, I mean, clearly would be on that list of social media.
And Desmond, I know you're going to push back a little bit on this. We have about a minute before the break, but I'm guessing you're thinking that if we do this, like there's some cost to it if we do like a blanket ban 16 and under. I mean, what would be your pushback on that?
Look, I think the thing that Gene and I both agree on is that we need to protect young people. We want them to have thriving lives. And so I am not opposed to this idea of verification. So one of the things that I experienced is that at a TikTok convening, there was a parent and a child that had been able to use some of the verification tools that TikTok offers and to create these new accounts for young people, for teenagers as well. And it was a beautiful experience because the parent and the child were talking about social media. Mm-hmm. The child felt really comfortable going to their mom and saying, I follow these people. I talk to these people. I know about these types of experiences online. I just want to make sure that we don't miss that with tools and other things that get in the way of the ability for a parent and child to have this beautiful conversation. And so one of the things that I want us to also be thinking about is what outcomes are we talking about? So you can talk to 50 people who think that social media is horrible, and then 50 other young people who are like, well, these verifications don't stop me from having poor mental health experiences and things like that.
So let's put a pin in that. We have another idea from you coming up the other side of this break. Yep. This is our Big Fix episode on young people and tech. We want your ideas, 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. Don't go anywhere. This is Studio 2 on WHYY.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, before we jump back into our Big Fix conversation about kids and tech, it is time to reveal our Giveaway Wednesday artist. I'll hit it.
That's my daughter in the water. Everything she owns, I bought her. Everything she owns.
Good song there about kids touching grass, actually, not being on social media. That is Loudon Wainwright III, if you didn't know. We have two pairs of tickets to see him in concert. It's happening Saturday, June 6th at 7 p.m. at the Bryn Mawr Twilight Series.
Yes, each pair of tickets is a $52 value. The first two people who email studio2@whyy.org and ask for the tickets will get a pair.
So, do it now.
And
first
ask.
Two.
Gotta ask for the tickets.
Now back to our conversation about kids and technology, how it's impacting them, and what we can and should do about it.
Yeah, let me reintroduce our three guests. We have Desmond Upton Patton, the Penn Integrates Knowledge Professor at the University of Pennsylvania and founding director of the Safe Lab. Gene Twenge, a psychology professor at San Diego State University and author of 10 Rules for Raising Kids in a High-Tech World, and Casey Mock, senior policy director of the Anxious Generation. He's also a lecturer in applied ethics and tech policy at Duke University.
Our question for you, how have you seen big tech impacting kids? What's your solution? How do you think about screen time in your own life? Our number is 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org, YouTube, Facebook. Comment in the live chat. Fascinating comment from Dave, who says, I advertise on these platforms for my clients. The targeting parameters are wild. Get rid of the ability for an advertiser to target by behaviors like just deleted a selfie, agreeing with something that Casey Mock said earlier. So let's go back to you, Desmond. Your second idea is for a national youth digital safety standard. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, absolutely. So where are the standards? I have spent my career talking to young Black and brown youth who live in neighborhoods with high rates of gun violence, and I have experienced firsthand what happens when a young person has access to highly addictive design features, right? Being able to jump on live features at any point has led to people being murdered, right? And so we have to think about what does it mean to have these design features that have probably never received input from community members. Another idea is having user-selected feeds as defaults, right? The young people that I work with, they are exposed to many types of people. And in some instances, that is positive. It can be great. And in other instances, that is really scary. Talking to adults who do not have good intentions for them, I think it's really scary as well. What does it mean to have independent audits of some of these platforms, right? But that also means that researchers need to have access to these platforms. Over the last 5 years, I've lost tremendous amounts of access to being able to study social media, to be able to have complicated and rigorous conversations.
Oh, interesting. Right? I didn't know that. So it used to be easier.
It used to be a lot easier, but policies have changed, right? And so companies have changed. Leaderships of companies have changed, right? So being able to be able to access, for all three of us to be able to access this data is really important for us to be able to have poignant and complicated conversations.
And when you talk about standards, I like to get really concrete because that sounds so squishy to me. So what you mentioned, the live, would there be features that are no longer available based on age? Like how would it work to make sure that the standards sort of apply and that you're still not encroaching upon access for adults, people who may not need this kind of reining in on standards.
Yeah, we need to be able to study the kind of features that cause harm or create joy, right? And so right now, having access to that kind of data is really complicated unless you have, different relationships with tech platforms, right? But I would love for us to think about, to Jean's point, if there is a verification, then what does it mean for a 13-year-old to be able to use different features on the platform? Is that creating a more harmonious life for them, a better digital life for them, or creating more harm for them as well? So these are the things that I hope that we are able to consider.
So what you're trying to say is if you're young, maybe you don't have access to the live or some of the other platforms. So you would have access, but a more limited access.
More limited access that is in conjunction with your parent or caregiver as well, so that you actually are having these conversations about, well, why don't you have this access, right? So, when you're in seventh grade, you learn about what it means to be a citizen of the world, right? You take social studies. But yet we don't have seventh graders that are taking courses on what it means to be a digital citizen, right? And so we need to still maintain this conversation around what does it mean to be a citizen of the digital world as well.
Yeah. Just in the interest of time, we're probably going to have to go now to Casey's second idea. Let me read in a couple more from our audience to make sure they're involved in the conversation. Miriam from West Philly says, I have two kids in their early 20s. They've always been free range on the internet. They both use social media in their jobs, so it's been really helpful for them. Brandy says, we have three kids, ages 13, 12, and 10. In our house, we have blocked internet access, social media, and YouTube on all iPads and iPhones except mine. And then one of those emojis. Things were getting out of hand, so we decided to dial everything back. It can feel hard to change course once kids already have access to devices, but we have found it's not too late to reset expectations, and it wasn't as painful as we expected. Casey, your second idea is maybe the most out of left field one, in the sense that I hadn't really heard it before, but it has to do with name, image, and likeness rights for everyone on the internet. So lay out this idea, explain it to folks, and then we can get into the details a little bit.
Yeah, so if you follow college sports at all, you've heard these terms over the last few years, name, image, and likeness. They've completely changed the landscape of college athletics, and athletes can now be paid for the use of their likeness on television and sales of jerseys and things like that, which certainly helps with fairness and compensation and all that sort of stuff. Now, imagine this transported to the internet. The internet is awash with all of our data, and particularly our kids' data. As Jean made the point that, there's kids under the age of 13 whose data is swirling around the internet and the companies are monetizing this. This is also what's happening in edtech with classrooms. Many of the educational technology products that are weaseling their way into classrooms are actually monetizing your kids' data after the fact. And so if we all each have a sort of digital copyright to our digital selves, and if that is used and abused by the companies and they have to compensate us fairly for that, that could change the entire incentive structure for how these companies operate. Right now, they have no incentive to be responsible with the collection, storage, or use of our data. And if they have to pay us fairly for it, then that all has to change.
So how would this operate? Like, how would I even know that a model is being trained on my image or that my work or that my data is being used to inform things about the algorithm or make business decisions? Like, how do you even get clarity into whether or not your likeness is being used so that you can be compensated if you so choose?
Well, if something like this were to pass, I think first the companies would need to be more selective when they're training an AI system about what data they're using in the first place, which that actually would create some benefit, as Desmond may actually from his work know much more than I do, because companies tend to take low-hanging fruit on the data that's out there. That means that there's lots of underrepresented groups and data structures, which leads to bias being baked into systems. So for example, systems used in schools with remote learning tend to flag African-American English as cheating or dangerous language because the systems are confused by that because the sample size is not as high, for example. And so if companies have to treat the input data more responsibly, they'll have a better sort of idea of a good quality data set. Now, Denmark has actually done this too. And they've used their copyright system to build upon this. So if someone violates your copyright, you can sue them for violating that. And it would work much the same way with notice and takedown, where, you know, someone has pirated a song, and if they don't take it down, then you can sue them for that.
Yeah, in my mind, I'm thinking about deepfakes. I saw a video recently where, you know, Paris Hilton has sort of taken on this and talked about how there's like literally tens of thousands of deepfake videos involving her, nudes and all sorts of things. And that could possibly be a solution to that portion of it, because we're seeing that that sort of bubbling up and becoming a real issue among young people who are online, Casey.
Absolutely. So the deepfake is the perfect use case for this, because the Take It Down Act passed in Congress last year, and that's certainly a good thing. But one, the solution that is it basically criminalizes the creation of the deepfake by the end user. Now, in many cases, this is going to be really hard for us to track that down. And what's happening is what we saw this last year with Grok just a few months ago, and the mass sort of undressing of women on the platform, is the platform bears some responsibility in enabling this behavior. And the way that they enable that behavior is having the digital imagery baked into the training data from the first point, and because they didn't have to pay anyone for it.
Yeah,
and they don't have to pay anyone for it if it's misused. Yeah,
so in this paradigm, though, if I wanted to let the platform use my name, image, and likeness, and I wanted to be compensated for it, I could do that? Like, I would have that option, Casey?
Correct, right? And it could be an income stream for people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so as people were worrying about AI create, you know, hollowing out jobs and stuff like that, this could be a way of the future too.
Yeah, and quickly, any reaction to Casey's pitch?
Yeah.
To Desmond, yeah?
Yeah, I love this idea. And I don't think it's theoretical. There is a new AI startup called Huma AI that has created a structure for how folks can say, I am okay with you using my data in this way, but pay me, right? And I think it allows people to make informed choices about how their data should be used or should not be used, and it creates another stream of income. And so I'm all for people being able to find new ways of being able to take things back from large tech platforms as well.
Yeah, Jane Twenge, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great idea. That's one of the things that we need to try to take the power back from the tech companies.
Ultimately, I think this comes back to something we've talked about a lot this hour, which is just incentives. Mm-hmm. And how do you like change the incentives that tech companies operate under? Are there other things in that vein, Casey, that you're thinking about, other specific concrete solutions that would just make it so it's less profitable to run the system the way it's run right now?
Well, there's legislation at the state level across the country that are a version of what my first idea is, which is outlawing certain design features by default for kids. Yeah. So New York has passed a law called the Safe for Kids Act that outlaws addictive design features on social media. And a number of states are also considering legislation banning manipulative chatbots pointed to minors that capitalize on human vulnerabilities. And I know Governor Shapiro's team in particular is interested in Pennsylvania going this way as well.
And the way those laws work is that the companies are liable in court for violations. That's the way it would work. It would be like through the court system.
It depends on the state and the practice, but in general, it builds upon existing product liability laws or consumer protection laws or fraud laws. So it's considered like a deceptive consumer practice, like false advertising in some instances.
Yeah. And as we get ready to wrap up, we have about 90 seconds left. Would love to get your idea. Like the one thing you think is the lowest hanging fruit for making a step in the positive direction of reducing some of the harm to kids that they're getting online and social media and through these devices. And Desmond, then we'll do Jean and then Casey.
Yeah, I'm still a big proponent of creating spaces for parents, caregivers, researchers, community members to talk about social media, to talk about the internet, to talk about their digital lives, and for them to be able to have easy access to research and data that makes sense to them so that they can make informed decisions like the one we heard from one of your guests.
Yeah, Jean.
I can't pick one, so I picked two. just changing that social norm around, you know, let's not give 10-year-old smartphones. Let's put that off until well into high school. And no phones during the school day bell to bell, which has really started to catch on across the country, I think would be really helpful as well.
And a lot of kids actually like that. And Casey, final word?
Just general accountability for the companies when they make products that hurt people, in particular kids. They've gone too far without any accountability at all. We're starting to see that change, thankfully. But more work needs to be done on that front for them to change their behavior.
Well, thank you all for participating in this conversation today. You just heard there from Casey Mock, Senior Policy Director at The Anxious Generation, lecturer in Applied Ethics and Tech Policy at Duke, and author of the Substack newsletter, Tomorrow's Mess. We also heard from Jean Twenge, psychology professor at San Diego State University and author of 10 Rules for Raising Kids in a High-Tech World. And finally, Desmond Upton Patton, the Penn Integrates Knowledge Professor at the University of Pennsylvania and founding director of The Safe Lab. Thank you all for being here today on Studio 2.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, and thank you to everybody who wrote in. And of course, thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel Mae Bryan, and Paige Marie Bessler. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer, Al Banks, and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Hey, guess what? We'll talk to you tomorrow.